Part 2, career.
So that's wonderful. Now let's start to pivot. Let's get you out of college. So you manage the apartment buildings. You've got the pancake house thing going on. You've got a couple of men and relationships that are positively influencing your life and your character.
Yes.
What happens then?
Well, then the gentleman that I was telling you about earlier from Archer City, he and I decide to go into business there in Albuquerque.
Okay.
And I started bought a company that basically was in the athletic realm, and it was basically a sporting goods store, and it was called Zia Sports. And what we did there was we created emblems for letter jackets and bowling shirts, and made patches and did baseball uniforms for the Little League baseball guys and that kind of thing. So we bought that business together, and that's what we did for the next 10 years. During that process, he had a heart attack and passed away. And so that was devastating to me, because he was someone I leaned on a great deal spiritually and mentally to kind of bounce things off of and talk to about things and that kind of thing, and now he was no longer around. So again, one more time, I was kind of looking and searching for, well, what do I do now? I mean, who do I look to now to give me that next phase of life that I don't know what that looks like yet? And so where do I find this individual? And I think I've spent my whole life basically looking for a father. Mm. and looked at different individuals over that time to kind of help me understand how you deal with things on the next level. So we ran that business for a number of years, and I noticed that my children were getting older and my wife's parents were getting older, and we said we need to get back to Texas. And so we decided to sell out and then move to Colleyville, Texas. So that's when we did that, and again, God in his infinite wisdom got the business sold in a fairly quick hurry, and got our house sold in a quick hurry. And the next thing you know, we show up here in Dallas, and we reconnected with a guy that was doing a lot of real estate and wanted to fill up shopping centers and that kind of thing with businesses, and I got involved with him to basically start another sporting goods store here in Dallas. And at the time, it was the biggest footprint. They didn't have all the things like you see now with Academy Sports and those great big footprints that are huge buildings and that kind of thing.
Right.
This was a brand new kind of a thought process, and so we created this kind of larger footprint called New Sports, and then put it in one of his shopping centers, and so I did that for a number of years and set it all up, and the point of sale systems and the purchasing and all that kind of stuff. I just took on and basically built this thing, and then unfortunately the economy crashed, and all of the real estate holdings and stuff that this guy had went south on him, and everything kind of went in the toilet here from a business perspective. Oil prices went way down. All kinds of bad things were happening to the Texas economy back in that time, in the 80s.
The bank collapse, and
yes.
My dad was in construction too, and the same thing happened.
Exactly.
It was from feast to famine.
Exactly. So from there, I had a friend by the name of Joe Bruyette. Hmm. And Joe was a president of a division of American Airlines at the time.
Yeah.
And he called me, and he and I talked one day because I'd coached his kids in Little League, and he saw some of the drive in me and saw some things in me that said, you know, that kind of can do, get the job done kind of spirit, I need to have him on my team. So he brought me in as a consultant at the time.
Okay.
And I wasn't a full-time employee. And as I got in there, I took on more and more and more and more responsibility. And he said, well, gosh, this is ridiculous that you're a consultant. We need to bring you on as a full-time employee, which, so I went, and that's how I got into American Airlines. So Joe ended up exiting American Airlines, and I ended up staying there and became division president of two different divisions while I was there. And again, and this really wasn't airline related at the time. One of them was a company that basically was in the training business, and we trained other people how to do TPF, which was a transaction processing facility, which was a high-end software program that basically American Airlines built the reservation system on. And they would teach other people in other countries how to do this, along with the stuff that was coming along at the time, Word and Excel and the brand new stuff that everybody and their brother knows how to do today. Back then, nobody knew how to do it, and so it was all brand new. And so we were doing those training programs for people like Shell Oil Company and different places. I was offered an opportunity to leave that presidency and move over into another presidency and basically do the revenue accounting for American Every Day down in Barbados. And we had about 2,500 employees that did that, some in Santo Domingo and some in Barbados. And basically took a handwritten ticket every day and took the information off of it that they flew down there and took the information off of it and sent it back to the revenue accounting so they'd know that Blake Leith flew 400 miles the day before and his revenue was this and he had this many miles charted to his mileage account and that kind of stuff. That we did all by hand.
Wow.
So Bob Crandall told me at the time when I took over that job, he said, you've got 6 months to get this business fixed up or I'm selling it. Mm. And so we had to figure out how we were going to not only do American Airlines' business, but other people's business that needed similar kind of things like waybills for Federal Express, American Express, that kind of thing.
Sure.
And medical applications and credit card applications, all that kind of stuff, because we had the employees to take it off of there. So my next challenge was, well, how do we stop the errors? I mean, because you just fraught with the you're taking human beings and asking them to extract this information off these tickets. So back then there was a new technology coming out called OCR, which is optical character recognition, which read stuff for you, and it was very limited at the time and had errors in it itself, so you had to error check the OCR, but it was still faster than it was by doing it by hand. Yeah. So anyway, we created this program to do that and ended up selling it to a lot of other companies and the business flourished I ended up making Bob happy and hopefully the American Airlines employees, stockholders happy. So anyway.
Right.
But I knew that the end of that was coming because ticketless travel was right around the corner, and I saw that coming down the line, and so I got recruited away from there and took over a call center business as the CEO, and where I could kind of run my own show, and left there and Bob called me in his office for an exit interview and said, you know, what do you, you know, why are you leaving? And I said, well, because I'm going to triple my salary. And he said, oh, that's a good reason. And so I decided, I mean, he decided, well, there's nothing we can do to compete with that. So so let me find out. So he said, well, what do you think about the business? I said, Bob, you need to sell this business as soon as you can, because the valuation is as high as it's ever going to be right now. And so sure enough, I leave that meeting with him, and no longer had I gotten out of the office than his guy that ended up being the president at some point later in life was Gerard Arpey, called me on the phone, said, what are you talking about, Bob? What are you talking to Bob about selling this business? And so I said, well, I told him about it. Well, he understood it right away, and he said, you're exactly right. So that's what they ended up doing. And sold the business after I'd left, but for a lot of money. So they again ended up doing very well.
Yeah.
And one of the things that I'll never forget, again, always looking for that mentor, for that thing that would catapult you to the next level. Bob Crandall was a master at taking complicated information and shrinking it down to the smallest denominator and getting people to understand it. And I watched that, and the way he would write his memos and things, and I was just blown away about how he could take such a complicated topic and break it down to such simplified terms so everybody could understand it.
Right.
And so that was a great learning experience for me, as well as his ability. He was a Wharton finance guy,
sure.
And I mean, he had financial controls that were
world class.
Absolutely, I mean, they were bulletproof. I mean, he put some systems together the financial controls inside American were just phenomenal.
Wow.
So anyway, those two things I took away from that opportunity to take forward in my career that really has been beneficial to me.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like you had good intuition yourself, and Joe obviously saw something in you when he recruited you and brought you in. You know, those are high compliments to Bob Crandall, but what personal skills do you think that you had learned through football and coaching and Zia Sports and all those sundry background activities that lent themselves to what you did?
Well, you know, I've been in front of a number of headhunters over the years for a lot of different reasons. And so they always, when they start breaking me down, you know, I've had the industrial psychologists do all the testing and all that kind of stuff. And all of them would say, what are you doing as the president of another company for? What are you doing being somebody else's hired gun? I mean, you ought to be an entrepreneur. I mean, that's what everything that you've done and the testing that we do on you says just screams entrepreneur. And I don't want to hear entrepreneur. I want to get that regular paycheck, and I want to move up the ladder in the corporation, because that's what you're supposed to do. You know, you start down here and you get up here. And I mean, what's complicated about that?
Yeah.
And so that's kind of was my mindset at the time. But now, again, as I've gotten older and I've looked back, I mean, I am an entrepreneur. I mean, my son is an entrepreneur. I mean, that's kind of what you do. You go out and say, I don't want to be beholden to other people to tell me to go left and right. I mean, if I go left and it's a mistake, then it's on me. If I go right and it's a winner, it's on me. Yeah. So basically, that's what I've done in the last part of my life is become an entrepreneur and own my own business and that kind of thing. And do you have the power structure and the top-notch employees working for you that I've had in the past? No. You don't. I mean, but you work around it. You figure out how you make it happen, even though you don't have those kinds of things. So,
right.
So those kind of events, again, are just one of the building blocks that have been put in place that have created who I am today, and have built the foundation that I've built my life on. So,
right. I like that story though, and that example. You know, I think. it's easy to take a high performing team and, you know, come in and assume them and sustain that maybe.
Exactly.
But it's this Pygmalion effect, this idea of someone comes in and takes the bad news bears.
Exactly, right.
You know, or blindsided or whatever it is, and they make them scrappy and gritty, and they give them a vision and a purpose, and, you know, and everybody rises to the expectations of them.
And you know, I really love that part of the corporate side of the world is that creating that vision and mission. And again, I think we do it so wrong in the United States today. I think everybody says, here's the vision and mission, like it.
Yeah.
Instead of saying, hey, listen, come in beside me, come along with me, and let's create this mission together. Let's create this vision together where you buy into it, I buy into it, we're all moving in the same direction. And you know, being spoon-fed stuff, I don't agree with, and I don't think it's the right way to do it. And I think you get much better results when you have people that have bought into your system, whatever that system is.
Right.
And great football coaches, that's what happens. That's why they're so good. That's why Belichick is so good, because he gets those guys to buy into his system, not you're going to do it this way or you're out of here.
That's right.
I want you to come along with me. Here's what we're going to try to accomplish together as a team. Let's go get that done.
Right.
So, and again, when you own your own business, you don't get to do that a lot. I mean, you have to do a lot of the stuff that other people do for you. And one of the things about being in the flooring business that I learned early on is, oh my gosh, where are all my good people that are jumping through hoops to make every command that I've talked about come true, right? So, but again, it's a thing that you have to do, because the people in the construction industry are not going to be the same people that are going to be your IT people and your Wharton MBAs and those kind of people that you can get when you're in a large corporation. So
sure, but you know, I mean, just as a personal anecdote, you know, the church that Don and I go to, we chose in large part because Sunday after Sunday, when we would arrive early, we would see our pastor sweeping the floors.
Yeah.
With a broom and a dustbin, right?
Yeah.
And we visited a lot of other churches where, you know, they had security detail and other people that did these things, right?
Yeah.
You know, and I told my wife, I said, this is where I want to be.
Yeah.
You know, because I think that's a role model for service. And if he's going to do that, it's going to be a great place for us to be connected.
Well, along that same line, when I bought this flooring company and I saw how people treated things differently than what I was used to in corporate America, I went out one day and I had all my subcontractors, my employees, everybody, and we had kind of a little meeting. And so I went out there and I said, look, does anybody have a $5 bill? And so one of the subcontractors pulled out a $5 bill out of his pocket. And I took the $5 bill and I tore it up into little bitty pieces right in front of them. And I threw it on the floor. And they're all going, what are you doing?
Right.
And you took this poor guy's $5 and you tore it up and threw it on the floor. Yeah. I said, guys, that's your money that I just put on this floor. That's your money.
Yeah.
And I said, do you see that bag of thin set over there? Do you see that piece of paper that's over there on the floor that nobody wants to bend over and pick up?
Right.
I said, this is your company, and you get paid for being here, and we all are going to either make it or break it together.
Right.
And so that's how I feel every time you break a piece of tile because you're just throwing the box in the back of your truck, right, or you're not being conservative with the materials that you're out there. You just, well, gosh, we got a 3/4 of a bag of thin set, throw in the trash can.
Right.
Well, that's $17 you just threw of my money away, of your money away.
Right.
So I can't give you a bonus. I can't pay you extra. I can't do anything else for you because you're willing to just throw that in the trash can.
Yeah.
And so I ended up giving the guy his $5 back, but still I made a point that you know, in order for us to make a business that's going to be viable here, we all have a responsibility to watch the dollars and cents. Again, Bob Crandall's
financial stewardship
is very, very critical in a small business. So
that's right. I think people get attracted to the independence of entrepreneurship and, you know, some sex appeal to it. I get to go off and be my own boss and do my own thing.
Yeah.
You know, but the reality is that you're up late Sunday night trying to balance the books, and Tuesday you're calling people for receivables.
Exactly. Exactly.
You get to be the crony.
Exactly. And a lot of risk. I mean, you've got to be willing to take a risk. And again, that's one of the things that I guess when you grow up with nothing, that you have to take a risk.
That's right.
Because if you don't, then you're going to always have nothing.
You're stuck.
Right.
Yeah, entrepreneurship's a powerful concept. You know, my wife majored in entrepreneurship, and you know, she had a lot of good role models that inspired her to do that.
Yeah.
You know, so we'll talk a little bit more about entrepreneurship. What are the kinds of things maybe that an entrepreneur may not love doing, or that may not come naturally, but you think that they need to do? Perhaps it's financial stewardship, or you know, obviously being comfortable with risk. Is there anything else that you can think of that you've seen in your own life story or others that differentiates a successful entrepreneur from perhaps a failing entrepreneur? I know some of it's just luck.
Yeah, absolutely.
Timing and, you know.
Well, absolutely. And again, I'll bring up before I told you that I hate it. I hate detail. I mean, I want to know the start. I want to know the finish and tell me the bottom line. I don't need to know how we get to the bottom line. I just need to
know
what the bottom. That's right. And did we make money or did we not make money?
Right.
And so so all of the minutiae inside that is stuff that, again, back to the American Airlines days, I could not go into Bob Crandall and not know the detail.
Yeah.
Because he was a master at catching you not knowing the detail.
Yes, he would find that.
Exactly. And if he saw that weakness, he would just...
Like a mongoose.
Oh, man. I'd just tear you up. So I had to learn, even though I hated it. I hate detail. I don't want to study the detail. Didn't want to look at the detail. I mean, I knew those financials back and forth. When we went into that meeting at the end of the month, I knew what my financials are. I knew what they meant, and I knew how we got there or didn't get there.
Right.
So... and if he's caught you trying to, skirt around the issue, I mean, he would just absolutely undress you right there in front of all your peers.
Yeah.
So you better know what they were. So, again, as an entrepreneur, you have to get into the detail.
Right.
No matter if you're capable of it or not, right. You've got to be able to figure out how you get down into the detail, because that's part of owning a business. You've got to know what makes it run and what makes it operate and where you're failing and where you're succeeding. So so I would say to me that would be a very critical thing for an entrepreneur. I'm not an anal person by any stretch, but you've got to figure out how you do it.
Yep.
Whether you're good at it or whether you hate it or not, you've got to learn how to do it.
Right. It's part of the bargain.
Exactly. And again, I didn't like some of the things that I went through but you had to go through it to get to where you are.
That's right.
So that's just part of life. And so you learn those lessons and you move on and you figure out, the things you've got to do to get there, right?
That's right. I mean, I think the way that you described it, when you look back, you know, you enjoyed football, and football was play. You know,
right.
It was a pleasant thing.
Right.
And maybe you wish you'd focused on your studies just a hair more.
Right.
and the same is true as an entrepreneur. You know, there are a lot of things about it that are fun.
Yes.
And pleasurable, and you say this is exciting, and you know, gets the juices flowing. And there are other things that, you know, late in the midnight hour, you have to sit at your computer and balance the books.
Exactly.
And pay people.
Yeah.
And keep things flowing.
Right.
Yeah. So.
And again, that's one of the things that my wife brings to the table. I mean, she does that for me, so I don't have to do that. Because if I had to do that, I think I would have pulled my hair out many years ago. And but she brings that part to the table for me, and has always.
Yep. I think that's common in entrepreneurial marriages.
Yeah, absolutely.
Where people complement each other.
Absolutely.
I know the same is true certainly for me.
Yeah.
As well. So that we can understand the arc then of your professional career. So you've left American Airlines. Because you mentioned the flooring company, and I know that happens at some point.
Right.
What happens in between there? What's happened since then?
Yeah, so...
And about, what year did you leave American Airlines?
1995.
Okay.
Yeah, that was my final year there. And so I got recruited from there to run a telemarketing company. And like I said, I was offered the CEO role, a very, very big salary bump, and that kind of thing. So... That was the reason I left American, and but then again I started seeing some of the things about the idea of, okay, well, you're running the operation, but you're really not running the operation because you've got an oversight board, and you've got a chairman that's looking over your shoulder, and you've got different people, and I saw early on that this company was way behind from a technology standpoint.
Mm.
And that they either were going to have to figure out how they stepped their game up from an IT perspective, or they were going to get left behind.
Yeah.
And just to give you an example, today there's what they call robotic calling, right?
Yes, sure.
And so it calls, and you've heard these clicks, and so you know kind of that this isn't a real person calling me because there's a delay there, right?
Right.
Well, they had none of that. Mm. It was, you pick up the phone, you make the dial, and if somebody answered the phone, great. If somebody didn't answer the phone, you hung up and dialed somebody else.
Wow.
So it was a real live person making the calls every time. And I knew that call, and to be proficient as a call center, you had to have some automation in place.
Yeah, you got to be scalable.
And they had none.
Right.
And so I was building that. And so as I was doing that, the chairman got a little concerned about the money that I was spending and how long it was taking to get there. And so he would call me in and question me about it. And so he finally brought in a consultant. And this consultant said, well, you're spending so much time on your revenue engine's dying right here in front of you, and you don't even see it because you're spending so much time to try to get the technology. And so when that happened, we started having some differences there. And
yep.
So I finally went to the chairman and said, look, you hired me to run this company, and I'm running it, and I'm telling you this is where you needed to go.
That's right.
And you're either going to listen to me or you're going to listen to your consultant. And it's okay with me, either one, but one of us is going. And so I said, let's make that decision. So we did, and I left. But at that point, I said to myself, look, I'm tired of being beholden to somebody else. If I'm going to go out and give somebody some of my best knowledge, and they don't want to take it, that's okay.
Right.
But I'm not going to do this anymore. I'm going to go do my own thing. So that's how I ended up finding the construction industry at the time. In Texas at that time, I mean, it was blowing and going. I mean, it was really
hot,
dynamite, and everybody was killing them in the construction industry. So. Or just a lot of industries, not oil, gas, I mean, real estate, everything was really
boom,
booming.
Yeah.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, that's how I got into the flooring business, decided to just step out again. I've done this a couple of times in my career. This was another time I've done it. In between there, I was a consultant for a while for a company called De La Porte & Associates, and another company called Accenture.
Mm.
And so I did some consulting stints in there, which again benefited my long-term perspective on things, but was just a fill-in for a time when I was trying to find my next deal, which
right.
was get out there and be an entrepreneur again, so.
Right. So where are you today in terms of where you spend your time and the kinds of tasks and work and entrepreneurship that you do?
Yeah, I sold my business a couple of years ago and to a company and decided that it was a good opportunity, good time to get out. It was, again, the economy in Texas was not in good shape. It was 2008, basically, and the real estate industry had kind of taken another dip. The oil business had taken a dip, and so the real estate market had fallen off. People weren't buying homes like they were. My business started kind of declining a little bit from a revenue standpoint. I had to lay off a number of people, and I didn't like that feeling. I didn't like what that felt like. And a bigger company came in and said, "Well, we'd like to buy your company." And so I saw that as an opportunity to do that and then go to work for that company, which I did for 2 years. And then my agreement with them basically ran out. I guess it was 3 years, but my agreement with them ran out. And I just said, okay, well, that's going to do it for me. I'm going to go home and sit in the lounge chair and play golf on the every day I want to and just have a good time.
Yeah.
Well, that lasted about 3 days. And I said, what in the world am I going to do tomorrow after the third day? So
right.
I said, I can't do this. I'm not wired that way. I can't sit around and do nothing. I like golf, but I don't like it that much. And there's nothing that I have to fill up my days. And so
purposeless.
Exactly. So I said, I'll start my business up again, which I did. Had a lot of customers that started calling me again and had kept in touch with me over the years. So it was fairly easy to get back into the business, except this time I'm not anywhere near as driven, if you will, as I was back then when I bought it the first time, because growth is not that important to me. Maintenance is that. Customer service is important to me.
Right.
I make sure that I deliver on what I can deliver on. You know, one of the things that I talked to my friend Terry DeLaporte about many years ago was that if we could ever find a business that didn't have any employees and didn't have any customers, we need to jump right in that business and get all we can get of that.
As fast as we can.
Exactly, as fast as we can. So I've got half of that equation beat. I don't have any employees and just have subcontractors and customers. So I've got one half of the equation done.
Yes.
If I can get rid of the customers now, I'm golden.
That's pretty clever, yeah.
So, yeah. So, but anyway, to fill up my days today, I'm basically doing selling. I sell. We go out and make sales calls, and I deliver on my promise that we'll be out there tomorrow and at a certain time. And that's one of the naive things that I thought when I got into the construction business way back when, because I went to my wife and I said, babe, listen, the construction industry sucks. I said, you know, I mean, nobody does what they said they're going to do. They don't show up when they say they're going to show up. They don't deliver what they promise when they get there.
At the
price agreed to. All those kinds of things. I said, man, any moron can make this thing work.
And she said, I got a job for you.
Exactly. So okay, well, let's get in the construction business. So, again, once you get in it, what do you find out? Well, a lot of the construction business is depending on other people down the line. And and if somebody tells you they're going to be there at 7 o'clock and you tell your customer they're going to be at 7 o'clock and they don't show up until 9 o'clock, that's 2 hours that you told them they're sitting there waiting, twiddling their thumbs while your guy is stuck in traffic or somewhere because he didn't make the commitment. You did.
Right.
So those kinds of things, I've kind of joked about this over time. That's what you manage in the construction business is to get people to do, other people to get to do what you've promised that they will do. So, and that's a challenge in the construction business because things happen and vehicles break down, people get sick.
That's right.
All those kind of things happen. So But anyway, that's kind of my day in and day out life, and it's not as stressful as it was because I don't have any employees, so I'm not dealing with that issue, and it's much easier to deal with the ups and downs of the construction industry when you don't have that piece of it to deal with. So
right, I think you and I probably read the same book at about the same time. I don't know if you remember this, but in the late 90s, there was an author called Michael Gerber, and he wrote a book called E-Myth.
Yes.
And the E-Myth is the entrepreneurial myth. It's that the person who's great at starting a company is also great at running and growing a company.
Exactly.
And often those skill sets are in contradiction.
Right.
As I think you've described a little bit throughout your career. But one of the beautiful things that he talks about in there is, you know, the transition from being an employee to being an executive, if you will, of an enterprise. And the difference is that you work, rather at the very beginning, you start working for the company, and then you evolve to working in the company, and then you graduate to working on the company.
Yeah.
And I think it's a huge epiphany for a lot of entrepreneurs and leaders when they realize, hey, you know, I can be beholden to this enterprise or I can grab hold of it.
Yeah.
And it works for me, I don't work for it. So it sounds like you've cracked that code with your no customers and no employees. You've got the place where you figured out how to work on it.
Exactly.
And have it work for you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, one of the things that I told a couple of young guys the other day, because they're both in their early careers, and I basically told them, I said, look, companies are looking for people today. If your goal is to climb that ladder and to be noticed and be recognized, when you start trying to climb that ladder, what they're looking for is someone who will take a risk and then take an ownership of that risk.
Yeah.
And to be right most of the time.
Yeah.
And I said, if you can figure out how to do those three things, you'll climb the ladder, because that's what they're looking for.
Yep.
They're not looking for the smartest person in the room.
Right.
And you don't have to be the smartest person in the room.
Right.
But you've got to be able to say, I'll take a risk.
Yep.
And then I'll take ownership of that risk.
Right.
And then hopefully I've made the right decision, and we're going to go in the right direction.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that's a good lesson for us all.
Yeah. A good gut.
Exactly.
And I've got a friend that describes it as a good picker.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, his picker's broken.
Exactly.
Or hers works, and so that's a great way to think about, you know, because more often than not, at least, to pick it right.
Right.
Yeah, and to choose it. Well, I mean, you've had a tremendous career. When you kind of look back now at its entirety, you've talked a little bit about, you know, two or three gentlemen in particular that influenced you positively. Can you think of any other sources of influence, be it people or books or experiences or just anything that you found to be pivotal?
Well, again, I had a really good friend. I was telling you about him earlier, Terry DeLaporte, who is your father-in-law. And he was a very good friend to me, and we were lifelong friends. And so he was someone who was very influential in my life, because he took me through a training class early on about how do you read people and how do you look at them and how do you understand their social styles.
Right.
And that social styles thing made an big impact on me. I went through that class and became a big believer in it. And basically practiced it all my career. So the kinds of things that you walked away from that. So Terry was a very, very good friend, and it was a big loss when I lost him as my friend, and he went to be with the Lord. So those are times that I look back very fondly at and say that made a huge impact in my life and my career. So.
Yeah.
Other things, I mean, I've read a lot of different books and Driven and the getting everybody on the bus.
Good to Great, Jim Collins.
Good to Great,
right?
And getting everybody to sit in the right seats and all those kinds of things are good metaphors,
right,
that help you to understand, you know, things that you can think about from a leadership standpoint of how you get things going in the right direction.
Right.
So, you know, I think, again, reading is critical from a leadership standpoint. You need to understand different perspectives, and you don't have to agree with them all.
Right.
But you at least have to be able to understand that there's different perspectives out there besides your own.
That's right.
And you've got to be willing to open your mind to at least hear those and to understand them and to learn from them. And again, you may or may not subscribe to all of the thoughts,
right,
because they're not all correct, but they're at least things that you can say to yourself that either makes sense to me or it doesn't, and you check it off your list and say, I'm going that direction or I'm not going that direction, and we can agree to disagree on some things, but you also can find some things, some nuggets in there that make sense to you. So
right. Yeah, the majority of people that I've interviewed for this series are seasoned. You know, they're at the tail end of their career or literally at the end, or they've already retired.
Sure.
And three or four of them have mentioned the book Halftime.
Halftime.
By Bob Buford.
Mm-hmm.
And in it, he describes, we live the first half of our career for success, and then the second half, or at least the second half of our life, for significance.
Right.
We touched on regret a little bit earlier in the interview, and you described that you don't have any, and we sort of tied it to testimony and other things. But you know, if you look back now over its entirety, is there anything that you would do different, or that you wish you could go back and change?
You know, today the millennials, have a different way of raising their children than I did. Again, much more disciplined, much more I'm not your friend, I'm your parent kind of attitude.
Right.
Today, the millennials, they want to be their friends and embrace them and to coddle them and to do some things. And again, I'm not going to judge, but time will judge to see whether that works out or not.
Right.
And I guess one of the regrets that I would have is I would have maybe raised my children a little differently, in that I would have been more willing to hear their perspective on things rather than me commanding and demanding my direction on them.
Yeah.
And again, my daughter and I struggled with that big time when she was in high school.
She's a strong-willed person, as I recall.
Exactly, very strong-willed. My son, on the other hand, he was totally different than that. He was very willing to appease whatever I asked him to do. He was willing to go that direction. Shannon was a contrarian, and if I told her to go right, she wanted to go left.
Right.
And so I probably didn't handle her like I should have. But again, it's something that I learned over time,
right,
not that I knew at the time, because
that's
again,
right,
I was a young parent and I didn't have any book that tells me, hey, do this and do that.
Right.
So, but now that I've seen the results of that, I would have liked to have done that a little differently.
Yeah, it feels akin to the epiphany you had, I guess, in the early 90s with Bob Crandall, when you observed that the best way to create a vision and mission that people buy into is through inclusion.
Exactly.
And as a parent, you know, we can lean on to our kids and
yep,
say, this is what I want you to be, and this is what you're going to do, and this is where we're going to go and how it's going to happen.
Yes.
Or, you know, we can spend some time alongside them and help them figure out, you know, for themselves. And
well, one of the things, again, that happened after she had already kind of gone through those stages and gone off to college and those kind of things. That's when I was going through this psychoanalysis, if you will.
Right.
So the psychologist would come in and quiz you about this. I took social styles, all those kind of things. So I started seeing myself differently.
Yeah.
Because one of the things that came out, and I've told this story many times, people see you as closed off. They see you as being aloof. They see you as being my way or the highway. And I'm going, well, wait a minute. I don't
feel that way.
That's not who I am. That's right. Not really who I am.
Right.
Well, yeah, but all these other people that are putting assessments together are seeing you that way.
Yes.
So no matter what you think of yourself, somehow other people are seeing you different.
Right.
And so that was a big aha moment for me in my life.
Wow.
Really a big time aha that said, okay, wait a minute. I'm seeing myself totally different than other people are seeing around me. I need to change that.
That's right.
And because the industrial psychologist told me that exact thing. If you're going to move up the ladder, you've got to start seeing yourself like other people see you, not like you see yourself.
Right.
And so I started consciously making a huge
concerted, intentional effort.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Push to change that.
Right.
And so... again, my wife tells me even today that I have a tendency to fall back into that mode from time to time, but I've tried really hard in my career to say, you've got to be willing to open yourself up to where people see that you're willing to make a change.
Right.
Because my idea was always, look, if you bring me a compelling reason why I should make a change or I should do something different, then I'm willing to listen to you. I'm open to hear that.
Right.
But if you don't feel like you can come in and have that conversation with me, then that never happens.
Right.
So I've got to be willing to show a side of myself that says, hey, listen, if you've got a better idea, bring it to me. Let's right. talk about it. Let's right. discuss it. And then when you do that, what do you get? You get a better decision because you've had that conversation, because now you've got other input other than people just leaving it all up to you.
Right.
So
it creates a much more open environment.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, I think one of your, you know, key traits is you're pretty intense.
Yes, exactly.
You know, and I think that intensity
yes.
for people, you know, might be for some people intimidating.
Exactly.
You know, I don't know that I want to take this to Bob.
Exactly.
I don't know.
I'm not walking through that door.
Well, you know, so we get now to sort of a third area here as we sort of near the conclusion. So now you're obviously still a father, and now you're a grandfather. And you've talked a little bit about your personal epiphanies throughout the psychoanalysis, you know, of your career. Have you softened any? Are you gentler in your relationships? How would you describe yourself as a grandfather?
Yeah, you know, that's always different. Your children, now you got your grandchildren, and you have no say in what they do, and so everything's okay with them, and so they can get by with murder, and no big deal.
Right.
But yes, I mean, I have softened, and again, I will say that from time to time, I do kind of fall back into that, but I try to catch myself in doing that, because it that tendency is there, and it's
hardwired.
Exactly. And I have a kind of a demeanor and my face, facial expression, some of that, it is very gruff and kind of in your face. And so when I say something, I'm not saying it because it's an absolute.
Right.
I'm saying it because that's the way I say things.
Right.
And if you want to come back and refute that, or you have a different opinion about that, okay.
Right.
I'm good with that. And so I can soften right up. But I'm very passionate about when I make a statement about the morality of the United States of America today sucks.
Right.
And I mean, you better come back and have a compelling reason why it doesn't, because that's my belief, and I don't think it's very good, and I think we're going down the wrong road here, and we're going to have to make some changes, or we're going to be in trouble as a country, or are in trouble as a country.
Right.
And so that's a real strong belief I have, and so if you've got a compelling argument that's going to be against that, then tell me what it is, and convince me that it's not, and let's have that debate.
Yeah.
So.
Well, that's a great segue then to just sort of some social observations, you know. So, you know, give me your point of view on discourse in the country, right? Because it seems very divided and pretty tribal. Do you have any wisdom or thoughts about what this country needs to do to move forward?
You know, again, I mean, there's the whole idea about this political correctness has gotten way, way, way overboard. And, you know, we've got to come back to a middle ground somewhere where it's okay for me to have a difference of an opinion with you.
Right.
But if I have a difference of opinion with you, I don't have to hate you because of it.
Right.
I can just have a difference of opinion with you.
Yeah.
And so, like I said before, we'll just have to agree to disagree.
Right.
And that's okay.
Yeah.
You've got your belief system. I've got my belief system. It's not the same as yours. And I can live with that.
Yeah.
What I can't live with is you hating me because I disagree with the way you believe.
Right.
Because my upbringing doesn't say I hate you. It says I love you no matter what you believe in.
Right.
And I would hope that you could see my point of view, but if you can't, that's okay. We'll move on.
Right.
And we'll get around that. But today, it seems to me like people don't have that mindset. It's got to be I don't like you because you believe that way.
Right.
And I don't like the behavior, but I like you.
Right.
And I can do that,
right?
So on the other side of that coin, I need you to feel that same way. And if you feel that same way, man, we can make a lot of progress.
Yeah.
So how do we get back to that point in the United States? And that's where I think the whole idea about the family breaking down and the divorce rate and the prayer out of school and not being able to discuss the Bible in a classroom and to take the Ten Commandments. I mean, who's against the Ten Commandments? I mean, who can possibly be against the Ten Commandments, right? I mean, those are things that we can all agree to, but yet it's a big division here.
Sure.
That you can't put the Ten Commandments on a courthouse.
Right.
So that there's a big disconnect for me there. And again, there's that hate factor that's out there that says, if you believe that, then I hate you for it.
Right.
So anyway.
Yeah, we demonize people.
Exactly.
And we start to treat them as objects.
Exactly. You know,
they're things, and those people are crazy, and they're idiots. And that's not the path to love, and it's really not the path to understanding.
Exactly.
Right? You know, and I think there's a lot of violence, obviously, and, you know, of late there's been a lot in the news about sexual harassment and those kinds of things. Do you have any advice or suggestions for a leader or manager about how to conduct themselves in a professional setting or in the course of their daily lives?
Yes, I do. And unfortunately, it's not a real popular opinion, Vice President Pence mm-hmm. was accused of being a prude and out of touch, but he's not going to go have a meeting with another woman that his wife's not present.
Mm, right.
And then just a few months later, I'm not talking 6 months maybe.
Right.
All of this stuff breaks out in Hollywood about the sexual harassment that's going on there, and now Judge Moore in Alabama and all those kind of things.
Right, pervasive.
Well,
yeah.
Well, wait a minute. You just told me that Pence was approved and was stupid about doing that. But yet now you find out, well his wife's sitting there. That ain't going to happen.
Right.
So that seems to me like a pretty good way to do things.
Right.
And when I was at American Airlines, I did not have a meeting ever with a female in my office that there wasn't at least an HR person or another person in the room with me.
Yeah.
And I did that for a specific reason, because again, it when an accusation's made, it's out there forever.
Right.
And even if
can't
you
take,
prove
take
it,
the stain back, yeah.
Even if you prove it not to be the case,
right.
Guess what?
Right.
It's still there.
Yep.
And you
tarnished.
Can't take it back. And once that elephant is out of the room, mm-hmm. I mean, it's still huge right out there. So
right.
You can't put it back in the bottle. So again. I mean, to me, that's the way you handle it. And it doesn't have to be your wife all the time. It can be other people in the room.
Right.
But when I'm not going to have a one-on-one meeting with someone that is not my wife, that I don't have some other people around me that can verify what went on or what didn't go on.
Right.
Right?
Right.
And again, I, there's so many things that are hidden and covered up, and I think they're going to be undiscovered or rediscovered here as we go through this process.
Oh boy.
That a lot of our congresspeople, a lot of our senators are having those kinds of issues,
right.
That you don't even know anything about.
That's right. I mean, every day there's something more.
Exactly.
That we discover.
And so I think it's a very easy solution, but if you want to be known as a prude, then that's fine with me.
Yeah, I'll accept that as the alternative.
Exactly.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, you gave me that advice 20 years ago.
Yeah.
And at the time I thought, well, why is that going to be a problem?
Right.
And then there came a point where I had an employee that, you know, happily married, beautiful young woman, and she came to me and she said, by the way, my husband have an agreement that if I ever meet with, you know, a man, that I never do so alone.
Yeah.
You know, and I was, it was powerful.
Yeah.
I thought, well, good for you too.
Yeah.
That's like, something that we're trying to do as well, right?
Absolutely.
So, I think that's good advice. Fireside is produced by Leith Group. Editing and mixing by Rob Rigdon. Technical support by J.R. Forresteros, Richard and Heather Vanderdice, and Clay Morgan. Research by Dave Rigdon. Special thanks to all our interviewees, and to Katie Bird and Dawn Leith. Coordination and transcription services by Amy Taylor. Fireside episodes are available for download at leithgroup.com/blog. You can also find Fireside and other Leith Group productions on LinkedIn, Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Leith Group and Blake Leith. A reminder that you don't have to wait for part 3 of my interview with Bob Gaines. All 3 are available for download right now.